Hey folks, before we get to our next episode, I wanted to ask you to consider leaving a tip at my website, wordballoon.com, and joining what I'm calling the League of Word Balloon Listeners. Now that we're entering our seventh year of Word Balloon Podcasts and being a broadcast guy, I've avoided doing a pay subscription model for the show. But the reality is there are production costs. Whether it's updating equipment, traveling to conventions for more guest interviews and panels, or frankly earning something for the effort of producing 12 to 15 hours of show content every month. I know it's a tough economy. That's why I'm happy to keep the show a free product as long as possible. But if you can swing a couple dollars, do me a favor. Go to the front page of wordballoon.com, hit the PayPal button that will provide a Dropbox, and give what you can. As always, thank you for your support. In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, beaten but not bowed by C2E2. Man, I'll tell you, I left at 4 p.m. exhausted because I had such a great time and I had very successful panels, and I'm very proud to present one of those today on this edition of Word Balloon. Now, if you listen to the Oh Yeah podcast, that episode that's coming up later this week will feature that live panel that we did. But on this episode of Word Balloon, I'm going to present to you the Lost 1979 comic book documentary panel featuring Mike Gold, who you remember as a former editor at DC. He also worked in the public relations department there and was on site when this documentary was made. We also have Douglas Klauba, my good friend who's been on previous Word Balloons. You know Doug is the former cover artist for books like The Phantom for Moonstone. He also did all those great origin pieces, the two-page painted pieces in the back of Project Superpowers for Dynamite, and Doug was responsible for discovering the 1979 comic book documentary. The full story happens on the panel. Great Q&A sessions. You're going to hear a lot of information about DC and Marvel, things that are covered in the film, but also some bonus information about guys like Joe Kubert, his years at St. John's Publishing in the early 50s with his collaborator Norman Maurer, some interesting sidebar comments from Mike about that. I think a really good presentation of what you're going to see if you see the Lost Comics documentary panel at conventions coming up later this year. We also have a little time to present a quick podcasting session with myself and representatives from Raging Bullets and Comic Geek Speak. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's all happening on this edition of Word Balloon, and it's all sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, if you place orders of $50 or more, you get free shipping, and they make it easy when they give you deals like Severed, 50% off, just $12.49. How about Daredevil Season 1, the premium hardcover, is just $15.49. Doc Savage, Volume 57, $11.21. Hitman, the trade paperback, Volume 6, for tomorrow, just 40% off, $17.99. Or the great character Panther, presented by the Vampirella Masters series, trade paperback volume 7, $13.99 at InStockTrades.com. Great month-wide savings on things like IDW and Boom Studio books, 40% off. DC trade paperbacks and hardcovers, 40% off. An easy way to find the titles that you're looking for with their power search. You can look by title, publisher, writer, or artist and find exactly what you're looking for at prices you won't believe. Check it out for yourself. It's waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. Now, you can tell my voice is a little bit roached. I keep getting whammied, kids. I don't know what the hell's going on. I had a cold going into Emerald City and did myself no good and got con flu. I managed to stay healthy on this one, but talking to everybody, meeting everybody, not only at my table, but also, you know, talking at panels and going to various creators' panels and stuff and tables. It was great seeing everybody. So that's why the voice is a little bit roached. Don't fear. I have a feeling I'll be back to full strength by the next episode. But now I want to present to you this great C2E2 panel. The first of many panels I hope to do at other conventions this year. It's the Lost 1979 comic book documentary. You'll hear the backstory, and I hope you enjoy it. But the sound is pretty good. I wasn't able to plug into the sound system at McCormick Place for C2E2. They have it literally in the walls, and you have to special request in advance. But luckily, I've got the trusty tools of ignorance, as I call them, the Word Balloon recorder there. And I think everybody sounds very good. You can hear the questions from the audience as well. A nice, informal discussion about this documentary and all the behind-the-scenes information we can gather about it so far. So check it out. It's coming up right now on Word Balloon. Thanks very much for coming out. I really appreciate it. Welcome to the Lost 1979 Comics Documentary.
I'm John Sutris. I do a podcast called Word Balloon. And do you guys listen?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys coming out. We have a great panel. Mike Gold, who you might know from his great work at DC Comics, doing things like Legends and Hawkman and Green Arrow and... What was Tim's? Tim was Hawkworld. What was
Wasteland? It's from Wasteland. It's my favorite.
And there you go. And of course, currently of ComicMix.com, which is a great news website. Denny O'Neill writes for him. John Ostrander writes for him. So many really great comic professionals. It's a wonderful site. And of course, Mike writes for him. And as you'll hear, you're going to hear some great stories today. And Mike was working for DC at the time that this was shot, so he's going to have a lot of good insight in it. Also, the man who discovered the film on eBay of all places. Cover artist Douglas Klaba, who you know from his work at Dynamite on Project Superpowers. Doug did the two-page origins, like in that Alex Ross style, for all those public domain heroes and stuff. But Doug was the man who painted those wonderful origins. And Doug's going to talk about discovering the film. Plus, Doug is friends with several of the people that are involved in the movie, and he can tell you some personal anecdotes about what he knows about the creators of the movie. So, yeah, exactly. So those are the public anecdotes or whatever. Sir, thank you. So, something, we're going to watch the movie, and then we'll talk about the movie. I do want to explain very quickly how it, you know, fell in our laps. Doug, you found it on eBay, right?
Yeah, just doing a little search. I was actually trying to find some stuff on the old Chicago Comic-Con from the 1970s, programs, and maybe some photographs. Yeah, I know.
But there you go.
I still had some of my programs, but I didn't have some of the earlier ones. They got lost in moves of mine. And I just kind of wanted to see if any of that was out there. I ended up finding stuff, but the more I kept eBaying the description of Comic-Con or Chicago Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con stuff was coming up, and this film showed up.
And what we can figure out for now is, it's ridiculous, I sound like an archaeologist, but that's kind of what we're trying to do, is really find out the background of this thing. You'll see the media company that produced it, they don't exist anymore. It was made for Canadian television. And the narrator, I should point out before we get started, is comedian Jonathan Winters. And he doesn't really, no Maude Frickett, no real fun. Yeah, which is kind of cool. Yeah, I'm telling you, man, this is star-studded. Star-studded. So, but it was made for this Canadian television series called Behind the Scene. Can't find any information on Behind the Scene. I found one producer who had a blog. His blog is down, so I can't even contact him anymore. So really, this is a big mystery, and I'm in radio, and I've got friends in Canada. I've got them working on it to try and find the background on this thing. It's 33 years old. We'll get more into it, but right now, let's show it. So if you're coming in, I'll let you take your seats, but it's pretty cool. I think you're going to have fun with it, and it's also, I point out that it was probably this print was made for libraries and schools because it's only 18 minutes long. And my guess is it was made for a school class or a library to show kids who have some sort of art aptitude. Hey, if you want to get into art and if you're looking for a job, these people make a living doing commercial art. This is how it works in comic book companies. And you're going to go behind the scenes at DC and Marvel, as I said in the description. You're going to see a lot of cool stuff. You can kind of tell from the menu page of some of the stuff that's being discussed. But I will let one more person come in and sit. Good to see you. I'm glad you came, man. Fantastic. We're filling in the room. Sir, yeah, by all means, free questions.
Do you have any plans on just uploading this to YouTube or anything?
I'm going
to
talk about that later, because after we show the movie. Because, and we were talking about it a little bit beforehand, too. I'd like to take it to a few more conventions as well before we put it up publicly and stuff. And really, technically, this is Doug's print, so go on.
Well, I do want to say that even though the film's in good condition, the color's faded. We do need to do some color correction on it. And so that's actually where we're at this point. It's in a rough state. It's just sitting in a can, really.
And further, one of the reasons why I'm bringing it to conventions and would like to continue to do it is I'd like to get more guys on like Mike in other cities that were working at DC or Marvel at the time, hopefully getting Jim Steranko involved. I talked to Neil Adams about coming on, and at first he said yes, and his wife, who was really kind about it, is like, you know, he's in a lot of panels, and if he's not at the table, we're not making money. And I can totally appreciate that. So he had to decline. But he gave me some very interesting background on the stuff, too. Initially, I called this the 1977 Lost documentary because a lot of the things they talk about are from 1977. And we'll get into that after the movie as well. But you'll see a copyright of 79. I'll get more into it. As Doug said, not only is the color a little washed out, but because it was a library and school copy, there's a couple splices and stuff. I mean, it's like watching like an old rerun you know, that, you know, and actually these days they've got all clean prints of all the 50s and 60s stuff. We are ready to rock. Okay, so let's let us begin.
This is the first issue of Detective Comics, from which DC Comics was later named. It's published in March 1937. Fu Manchu, a very popular character, was on the cover of our first issue.
Welcome, frantic ones, to the fabulous world of comic books, filled with color and action, handsome heroes, kryptonite green monsters, beautiful ladies. We're about to take a behind-the-scenes look at the incredible world of comic books. Remember all those old comic books your mother made you throw out? Well, yesterday's trash is today's masterpiece. This is a comic book convention, a fabulous fete where frantic, fanatic fans finally find that long-lost classic. For the price of a comic book, maybe a schoolboy's pocket money,
at least
for a millionaire's monthly allowance.
$7,000, probably. I was offered $900 on the Morphin 52 and I turned it down. I don't want to break him up. It's a set. That's the first half.
Haggling won't help, pal. Take it or leave it. The man is heavy.
That's $1,000 above a guy. The books aren't even new.
Okay, that's what, $3,000?
$1,500.
Okay. That's that is a deal.
Well, you know, I've been looking for these for a long time.
But conventions are only the tip of the iceberg in today's world of comic books. They become a big business with high stakes.
You know, the criminals catch him, they put him in a vat of cement and throw him in the water. And he comes back as a specter to fight crime.
New York City, the Big Apple. Yep, here it's action, action, action. And the people never stop. That's the world of high finance for you. Yes, in these buildings, two huge corporations are battling it out right now for sales that total millions and millions of smackaroos a year. Is it ITT versus AT&T? Perhaps at the United Nations, the great powers battling it out. Is it NBC battling ABC? No. This is the battle between the comic book empires of DC and Marvel. They fight, compete, bash, pow, swoosh. DC Superman and Marvel's Spider-Man in a classic punch-up. It's the only time the two companies have worked together. Naturally, both characters ended up winning.
Are these the shots for the human flight?
Right. These are the character sketches I had John Romita work up.
Great. Now, this is the way he really is.
This is it in real life, yeah. And this is the way Johnny's tried to glamorize it a bit.
Great.
Tightening the costume.
We took off the cape, huh?
Watch closely, because the Human Fly, a new Marvel comic, is about to be created before your very eyes. Stan Lee, the elder statesman on the right, and Archie Goodwin are working out the shtick.
Who may possibly be the Human Fly.
Yeah. This is the pilot, the TV reporter. Let's see, we'll put this with this one. These are the characters who are going to be the candidates for herodom, if we can find out which one is the real Human Fly, right? I like the pilot very much. Yeah, she's a black girl. That's good.
Stan Lee knows the importance of characters and shtick. A pioneer of modern comic books, he's written over 10,000 comic stories.
I think is really great for the TV reporter. That was a good touch.
Comics were about the cutest little animals. But today, when you talk comics, you talk heroes. Superheroes. They come in teams. They have fabulous powers. Their names are magic. The Silver Surfer. Namor, the Submariner. Conan the Barbarian. And the Incredible Hulk. Mannered reporter strolls unnoticed through downtown Metropolis. Does he look familiar, fans? Is this merely a disguise? Only a double identity? Look, up in the sky. Could it be? It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's... No, he isn't. He isn't even a reporter. I lied.
He's ace comics artist Neil Adams.
I already have Joe Namath. I already have Frank Sinatra.
Well, I think by having President Carter, yeah, our foremost citizen, our number one citizen, looking at the right in the.
What about Ford? What about Ford?
Ford, he should be right next to him.
On the back.
No, I don't think we should have Ford on the back.
But this is DC Comics, okay, neck and neck with Marvel.
Faces that are going to be on the cover. What about? Let's get into the story. I'm up to the sequence where Superman and Muhammad Ali are training together. And they're fighting in Superman's Fortress of Solitude. We've stopped time or slowed it down. And what I wanted to discuss basically today is that I would like, if possible, to have the aliens send down a couple of robots.
You mean robots like mechanical men, Robbie the robot,
right.
Bucket of Bolts kind of robots?
Right. Yes, and what I'd like to do is have Muhammad Ali start to fight them. Superman hasn't got his powers at the moment because he's in training.
He's still under the influence of the Red Sun and training for this big fight that's to come.
Right. And then he comes in and he and Ali are fighting the robots, right?
Yeah.
And he comes in and in his superhero fashion, standard Superman bit, takes him out, whereas Ali, savvy ring-wise, ring tactician,
right,
uses all of his boxing knowledge to win.
Actually, he's, in effect, saving Superman's life before Superman gets his powers back. Superman really isn't very good at this.
Yeah, he's the new boy on the block.
Right. Okay. And he's created a giant tidal wave, and Superman has to stop a tidal wave, very small guy. The only way he can stop it is by creating a force, a sonic force, by smashing the two most indestructible things in the world together, his fists. So he smashes them together in front of him. Boom! And the sonic wave stops the tidal wave, stops it instantly, and it falls.
Here's Ed Summers, a serious comic collector.
Pieces. The first thing that he ever did for Jumbo Comics number one was The Count of Monte Cristo. That's really pretty straight compared to some of Jack's other things, which are much more dynamic. It's what he developed later. Kirby at the time was going under the name of Jack Curtis because it wasn't really too decorous to be known as a comic book artist. It was pretty new. This is Kirby at his best. You can see here the qualities that Jack Kirby became famous for. The most obvious one is the exaggeration of the size of the hand, which makes it appear to come forward from the page. It's a technique, it's called foreshortening. It was used in the 16th century by some religious artists. Then over here he has the action lines with the hammer, so it really looks as though it's moving.
It's fans like Ed Summers that have taken comics from the newsstands and put them into the Museum of Modern Art. A fanatic fan will pay any price for some of the original artwork from the pencil of Neil Adams or a Steranko or from Jack King Kirby.
In Neil Adams' work, you can see that here's a drawing that's very similar to the Thor cover that we looked at before. It's different in Adam's work because the hand is very, very realistic. You can see that it's very similar, an enlarged portion of the body here and a smaller portion here, which makes the figure seem to come forward.
But back at DC Comics, 17-year-old Trevor Von Eaton, still in high school, is working on his first pro comic.
You're on vacation now?
Finish for school?
Yeah.
Class has ended on Tuesday.
Great, then you can finish the story. But there's some corrections we have to make on this. Let me show it to you. On the first panel here, Black Lightning's not quite big enough. So let's redrawing from the top to the bottom. All right?
Yeah, but if we do that, then we'd be hiding the logo.
It's all right. Because
at DC, first the writer usually creates a script. Then the artist sits down and draws, following the instructions. The result? A comic that tends to emphasize plot and words over art.
Like, look at this. This panel, right?
Yeah.
This is the first time he's talking, and even though he's already been established here, I think it's more important to have a close-up here than over there.
Okay, that's right, because it's his first speech. Okay, let's switch this around.
Because, you know, he's just sitting there.
Okay, let's have Clark's talking, him in the foreground here. Henderson in the background, then we pull him up for your close-up in the last panel.
I think,
that's this whole thing.
Meanwhile, back at Marvel.
How's it going with that team-up plot?
Pretty well.
Yeah, it looks like you got the splash going all right.
Yeah.
What do we got? Spider-Man and Thor?
And so, yeah.
Do you think by cropping in on Thor's hammer, we kind of lose a little of the motion? Maybe if we could move it in a bit.
At Marvel, they do things the other way around. The result? A comic that tends to emphasize art over words.
Because the way you've got everything else arranged, the layout and everything looks fine. I think if you can get that one thing, it'll really be dynamite.
That's no problem, sure.
Either way, working on Pro Comics is like working on an assembly line. First, one artist draws the majestic vision with a pencil. Then another artist goes over it in dark ink. Then somebody else colors it, and somebody else letters it. And a whole other crew gets together to do the covers. Maybe you think comics are just pictures of people walking, talking, and beating each other up. Well, comics are art, which means new ideas, new innovations.
It's a storytelling page. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels, each of which tells an element of the story. But if you look at the whole page all together, it forms a face. You have to step back from it a little bit. And again, in color, it was a little clearer because some of the elements are made more distinct. Comic book artists are not beneath having in-jokes. The lower panel in this has what's called anamorphic writing, which was also used by Dolly. If you pick it up and look at it this way, all of those long, crooked lines coalesce into letters. And you can read it. It says, hey, a Jim Steranko effect.
In the war of comics, there's only one match for Neil Adams, that far-out artwork of Jim Steranko, artist, author, publisher, and magician. Steranko is the tops in comic book avant-garde. He's flashy, bold, wildly visual. He revolutionized comic books like Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., and Captain America. What has he done for us lately? Chandler.
Remember when George Raft did that little coin flip in Scarface? Chandler uses the film symbolism that we've come to know in the old Warner Brothers films like The Big Sleep and The Maltese Falcon, with guys like Edward G. Robinson and Cagney, of course, and Humphrey Bogart. These men themselves have become symbols of that kind of tough guy, hard-bitten, private eye image, and that's what we're doing in Chandler. For example, automobiles, for instance, were a very common symbol in those Warner Brothers films. You'll find that there's a reoccurring image of black limousines, massive, expensive black cars like Black Mariahs are speeding along with Tommy gun muzzles sticking out of their windows, spraying death over gangland streets. We have a car sequence in Chandler, too. The telephone became a symbol for violence and fear in 40s films, and in Chandler we use a great many telephone shots. We knew that by seeing enough of those movies that whenever the telephone rang, it meant there would be intimidation, coercion, threats, some kind of violence, perhaps even death. Believe it or not, even something as obvious and apparent as Venetian blinds have become part of the imagery of B-films. Directors probably felt that because budgets were so low, they repeatedly used the imagery of Venetian blinds over and over again because they threw interesting patterns and shadows, some of them very menacing, on their characters, on the various sets, and it became part of the atmosphere of what has come to be known as film noir.
Okay, John.
Back at the convention, there's still lots going on. Apart from dealers' tables, where you can buy those old classics, comics conventions feature original art displays, panel discussions, movies, and a wild costume contest where you can get to be your favorite hero. Comics today not only exploit violence, they also exploit sex. Comics have never seen a hero who had a pot belly or a heroine who wasn't pneumatic. So why should the convention be any different? Let me say, this is a horrible example of sexism in action. So don't watch. Is this called having your cake and eating it too?
From the metal men. She was made out of platinum, I think.
Even Wonder Woman, one of the rare breed of heroines who had her own comic, still gave up much of her superpowers just to be around her boyfriend.
Our first prize winner.
You really think the winner will be a guy?
He is. Antonia Hawkins, Tina from the
book. But the comics war is far from over. In fact, it's just taken a new twist. The DC telephone hotline.
Hi, DC fans. This is Joe Orlando. Weird Western will now premiere Scalp Hunter.
a new breed of Western hero, when you see Jonah Hex now in his own comic. And first of the year, watch out for the adventures of our brand new superhero, Black Lightning, written by Tony Isabella and drawn by a new young super artist, Trevor Von Eden.
The DC Hubline, I guess, is a rather cute idea. Because I would like to feel that we at Marvel don't really need one as much because our readers, fans, and friends really know everything that's happening. We make a point of informing them. But no, it is a good idea. It's one of the few things I would wish that we had thought of first. But I think we have to give some points to the other side occasionally.
And who's it all for? All the high finance and the high pressure work, it's still for him, the kid on the street.
So that Lucerne Films at the end, they're a New York film distributor that would supply films for libraries and private clubs and schools. I contacted them. And they're like, it's not part of our catalog anymore. Again, this is 1979. I'm like, any information? Like, nothing. So, beyond the name, behind the scenes, knowing that it was this Canadian TV show, can't find the producers who made it. Best I can do is talk to guys who were there at the time. Mike is one of them. Mike, you were in the PR department back then?
Yeah.
Here, would you talk in the microphone because I want to make sure I get this from the podcast.
Actually, I was the PR department.
Oh, there you go. What do you remember?
This is the 70s. Who remembers anything? First of all, I'm really astonished. That was me in the first scene unlocking stuff.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's me. And I'm astonished at how much weight I put on. I'm glad my daughter's here now to see that. But at least, you know, I have hair.
Yeah.
So, one of the really cool things in those locked cabinets, by the way, and one of the many cool things, is that all of the original art to what was supposed to be Wiz Comics number one.
Wow.
Now, you may remember it as Wiz Comics number two, featuring Captain Marvel. But it was Captain Lightning, wasn't it?
Or Thunder.
Thunder, Captain Thunder.
Okay.
Thunder, Lightning.
Was that an ash can?
No.
Was number one?
No, it was never printed.
Okay.
They went back and changed the name, changed a couple of little design elements, all pasted up on top of the artwork. And DC got a hold of the artwork because of the lawsuit in the late 40s and 1950s.
With Fawcett, the original publisher.
Right. So the mere fact that I'm here today to talk to you and not in jail for having swiped that stuff befuddles me to no end. I also came up with the DC Hotline. And it's
how about that? That's really cool. Does anyone... I should ask, was anyone reading back in 79? And do you guys remember calling the DC Hotline? I called. My parents would get the bill. 50 cents! What is wrong with you?
But it's nice to hear Stan thank me. It kind of insulted me in Baltimore this year, this past year at the convention, because my intro at the Heroes Alliance Awards was longer than his. To which Mark Waid said, "That's because you're Stan Lee.
You need no introduction."
Those were great times. DC was about 35 people on staff, plus freelancers. And today DC has, I'm guessing, something in the neighborhood of 400 or 500 employees on staff. It's hard to say. I know there's about 80 to 100 out on the West Coast. The New York office is their parent and dad. That's where the editorial offices are. Trevor Von Eden, I work with to this day. We did a graphic novel called The Original Johnson. It came out last year. It was just beautiful. One of the most awesome and most underrated artists. He's no longer 17. But, you know, I'm no longer 27. So I guess that all works out. Jaxie Harris, who's in the office with him, is a freelance writer. Yep, there we go. Doing children's books and the like. He did a lot of writing for both DC and Marvel. Really good guy. One of the absolute nicest guys in the business. Denny O'Neill, severely underrated in terms of his work on the Muhammad Ali book because, you know, O'Neill sucks up the oxygen in the room. I'll tell you a quick story about that. They were here in Chicago to meet with the Ali people. Now, it just so happens that I knew Ali's lawyer. He had the office next door to my lawyer when I was in Chicago. And I met Ali in like the elevator once and stuff. So I was giving them tips and everything. The meeting was pushed back. They went to the Art Institute to kill about 4 hours. And as Denny reports, Neil took him to each and every piece in the Art Institute to tell him what was wrong. So Neil's art speaks for himself. I'm speaking for Neil. And the work was absolutely phenomenal. He is a fan. Neil worships Joe Kubert, as do I, as should you. Yeah. Joe is the original artist on the Ali book. The Ali people, he designed the cover. The Ali people didn't like his style. And I'm not sure about whether Muhammad Ali did or not, but they didn't like his style and rejected him as the artist, which...
Crazy.
Yeah, insane. But they like Neil, so, okay, that's pretty cool.
It's a good choice, absolutely. And of course, you guys know that, and I'm sorry I don't have an image of it, but the cover is so amazing. Julie, at the beginning of the scene, was talking about the different celebrities. I know there was difficulty in getting clearance after the cover was made of several celebrities.
It was a small problem here and there, and they kept on having to shift people around because some of the celebrities didn't want to be seated next to other celebrities on this cover of a mythical fight on another planet between some guy named Muhammad Ali. By the way, I'm on that cover too, and I'm sitting next to the guy who ran Warner Communications, which is now Time Warner, Steve Ross.
The guy who was in charge of Kinney before becoming part of Time Warner, or actually Warner Communications back then. Also, I know John Wayne was on the cover, didn't want to be on it, so they had to put a mustache on him to disguise him. And I know what started it, maybe it started as Telly Savalas, became Carol O'Connor? Something like that.
I don't remember that story.
Okay.
But it's ironic because Telly, well, it's not ironic, it's obvious. Telly was supposed to be in the first Superman movie. And when they brought in a new writer, and they brought in Richard Donner, somehow Telly kind of got lost.
Tom Mankiewicz was that writer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I worked with the two of them.
Very cool.
On that movie, and with Chris Reed. Just being in the same room as Tom Mankiewicz and that whole family history was just breathtaking to me. Dick Donner's just one of the nicest guys on the planet. That was fun.
And I love the Steranko segment, and I want to talk about Chandler, because Chandler is one of those books that people say was the first graphic novel. Obviously, since then, I know, I'm blanking now, Matt Baker and Arnold Drake in the 40s did a book-long graphic novel. It's called It Rhymes with Dust or Lust or whatever, but it was a cool kind of... Was it Lust?
Rust,
thank you, sir. Dark Horse reprinted that. But yeah, Chandler was one of those books. Doug, you're pals with Jim.
Yeah, and when I told him about the film, he had no recollection, which is weird because Jim remembers everything and he has an amazing memory. But it's... Unless that's really his studio, it looked like a set to me.
I know, that's the crazy
thing.
And
I told him, I said, you're sitting in a film noir set.
Maybe
you
drank too much of the whiskey.
I know, the Old Crow. That was awesome.
So they would have had to go out there, or he'd have to come to New York to film it. But he, all the only thing he said, he goes, yeah, I vaguely remember that being some Canadian production. I'm like, well, that's it. It is a Canadian production. That's all that his recollection was.
In 2009, I showed stills to Neil Adams, and he didn't remember. And then I put the clip of the story session on YouTube, and I sent him the link and stuff. And he's like, okay, now I do remember. And one of the reasons and the confusion about was it made in 77 or 79, even though the copyright was there, everything they talked about was from 76 or 77. Right. The Human Fly started in 77. They were working on Superman Ali starting in either 77 or 78.
We started working on it just before I was hired, and that's where I saw Joe's stuff. I saw it right before the first Chicago Comic Con. I was one of the organizers of the original Chicago Comic Con. And Jeanette Kahn, who by this point had already hired me, I wouldn't start to see until after that first convention, was showing me these beautiful drawings of Joe Kubert's. So that was the summer of 76.
Okay.
The book would have been out a lot earlier, but we had some sort of deadline problems with the artist.
Well, it was worth the wait. And the other thing that was, Steranko's Chandler was 76 or 77. It was put out by Brian Price. Brian Price's imprint.
For Pyramid Books,
there we go. I kind of thought that all this stuff might have been shot back in, like I said, 77, or I was assuming 77. Neil told me they recreated that story session for the Canadian producers. I'm assuming the same goes for Marvel. I haven't had the chance to talk to Stan about that. And actually haven't really had a chance to talk to a contemporary like Mike that was at Marvel at that same time period. Although, there's a great picture, and I don't know if you guys figured out who was next to Archie when they were talking, and maybe you see the character there, so you might already know. But that guy on the left, anybody know who that is?
John Romita Jr.
It is John Romita Jr. That is 100% correct. And I love the Vinnie Barbarino hair. You know who he looks like? He looks like the kid who played Billy Batson in the old Shazam TV show. So I'm hoping, I'd like to do this again in New York, and I'm going to talk to John and see, Marty Pascoe's going to do the panel, and Mike, obviously, if you're at the show, obviously, I want Mike there again. But it would be great to get somebody, and also, hopefully, I'm going to try and get Walt Simonson to maybe talk about it, too. Because I know, obviously, with his longtime collaboration with Archie, wasn't it great to see the Manhunter costume?
Yeah.
Really, no kidding. And think about that. That book was, 5 years old, and still had that kind of impact. That it was that kind of cool costume.
You want to hear a story about that?
Please.
That series had a wonderful pedigree and deserved it, absolutely. But the whole ninja thing and the whole martial arts thing really hadn't gotten to comics before that, and that didn't really start it. It was just a wonderful series back in Detective Comics. So DC ultimately reprinted it in trade paperback many years later. And Archie Goodwin had the office next to mine at DC and was one of we throw these words around a lot. He was one of the finest humans ever to walk the planet, and one of the most creative. Somebody approached Archie at a convention saying, "Well, you wrote this." He says, "Yeah, that's great." And he says, "Wow, and it came out back in the 70s. Yeah, it did. So how were you able to rip off Frank Miller so early? And that's, that kid became a Doctor Who fan or something. Because that's the only way you're going to explain that time reality.
I love that costume. Look at that.
Yeah.
And then, did you notice the girl all in silver? Did you hear who she was supposed to be?
No.
It was supposed to be Tina from the Metal Men.
Oh, what?
I don't remember her ever having the high collar and the cape, but yeah, they're like, yeah, Tina.
Her body.
In the right hands. No, I saw that. I remember Alan Davis doing it really hot.
Who was paying attention to the cape?
Yeah, exactly. Man.
That's much better.
Back in the day.
Bad.
This is true.
Yeah.
So, any questions about the thing? I'll talk a little more about it and everything. I know someone asked earlier, are we going to try and, put it out on DVD? I'm not sure, what the rights issues are. And I'll talk to Warner Disney, and I'm sure, Doug and I will talk about that. But, because there's so much trademark footage. However, I do think that we could, with fair use, use a lot of the skull sessions between Archie and Stan, and when Neil and Denny and Julie are talking and stuff. So I think we can, at the very least through fair use, use some of that footage. And again, that's why I'm doing, these panels and stuff. We'd like to continue in other cities and get more guys to talk about this. So maybe we could put together some sort of compilation.
I got a couple of good trademark lawyers.
There you go. You see, yeah, exactly. Mike knows. Mike was able to get back things like Sable and a lot of those wonderful...
Grimjack,
absolutely. So, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we're going to have to work on it. That's very good. So, yeah, please, questions, sir.
There was a montage later. There was I think it was Ballhead Man, older guy. I think it was McGeeking. Do we know who that was?
Yeah, I don't know who that was.
The bald-headed guy who was speaking at what point?
Inky.
Ah, yes, actually I do, and I'm glad you point that out, sir, because that man was, I feel like, Paul Harvey, this gentleman?
Yes.
Any guesses before I reveal?
Frank.
Who?
Jack Abel?
No.
Not Jack Abel.
Frank
Giacoya? Giacoya?
Yeah.
No, but that's a good guess, too. It's a Marvel guy.
Frank Chiamonti?
No, sir. This is good. I like this. This is like Jeopardy.
It's Senior.
It is John Romita Senior. Adrian is correct. That's exactly right. And isn't that amazing? Look at him. I'll even zoom in.
Where's the...
So, That's why I want to tell JR about it, because I have a feeling that if we get Junior, you know, maybe Dad will come. And he's always a good broker to get Dad. Dad's a good guy, but every now and then I've tried to get him on board, but he's like, I don't want to do that nonsense. And I'm like, all right, no worries. You're cool.
Loves movie service.
Really, Romina? Oh, that's a good idea. You know, Kubert yesterday, I don't know if you guys know, Kubert has a great connection to the Three Stooges. He and his good friend and collaborator, Norman Maurer, for a publisher called St. John back in the 50s, did Three Stooges comics. Oh. Norman, not only a fine comic artist in his own right, was Mo Howard's son-in-law. And back in...
That was because of the comics.
Is that true?
Yes, that's...
Wow, I had no idea. You see, there we go.
Because of the 3D comic.
Fantastic. They, Mo's daughter...
Sorry about that comic.
And I want to hear about Mo's daughter put out a book called The Three Stooges Scrapbook, and I interviewed Joan and Norman for that when I was a kid. And I was telling Joe, and Joe really lit up, and he's like, oh, I'd love to talk about that sometime. So hopefully on Warbling we'll get Joe to talk about St. John. But yeah, tell us about St. John.
All right, this is a very Chicago story. And you don't get any more Chicago than this. There are these two brothers named St. John. One of them owned a newspaper in Berwyn. The other one owned a newspaper in Cicero. Daily newspapers. They were both called the Tribune, which I find bizarre.
The Berwyn Tribune.
But, yeah. The Berwyn paper was running a series about Al Capone, and somehow they took a negative stand on the general. And one day, he was beset upon by tyrants and had the poop beat out of him and wound up in the hospital. Was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. When he left, he was told that Mr. Capone took care of all of the charges. And oh, by the way, Mr. Capone also bought the newspaper. So his brother Archer, who was a little bit more avant-garde, decided that perhaps Chicago wasn't the best place for him to live. So he moves out to New York and goes into the sleazy publishing business. After all, he was already a newspaper publisher. And it's publishing, you know, sort of confession magazines and that sort of thing. And he started up a comic book line, which he gave essentially to Norm Maurer and Joe Kubert to run. That's where Joe really perfected his contemporary style, as opposed to the stuff he was doing when he was a teenager during the Golden Age. He created Tor there and owned the rights to it, because Archer St. John, when he went out of business, said, yeah, screw it, take the rights. You know, you created it, you should have it. So in a sense, that's one of the pioneering comics rights stories and comics creator rights stories. And I think we all have Al Capone to thank for that. That and Jay's potato chips.
That's another story for another time. But 3D comics were really... Actually, I always think 3D comics worked better than 3D movies back then. And, they put so much money into that. And I know the first issues were huge sellers. And then, much like the 3D fad itself, tanked immediately and really wiped out St. John's. And it's a shame, because they had Mighty Mouse 3D comics, they had the Stooges. I think they had Abbott and Costello back then.
And they did two issues of Tor.
Yes,
and
Tor.
Sort of miscellaneous mystery books and that sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty cool. And you know, the Tomorrow's magazines always, you know, have every now and then they have stories about St. John's and stuff. Interesting imprint. So, any quick start?
Yeah, I just had a quick question. You said you found it on eBay initially?
Yeah.
So, the seller on eBay, who got it before you got it? Yeah. How did that
You know, I never asked him where he got it, but he bought it from somebody else as well. He said he was, because I asked him, I go, why did you buy it and where did you get it? He said I was going to work on a documentary and I was starting to just get some stuff together, and this was one of the things that he bought, and he just never really pursued it, and he put it up and he asked me, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I really don't know, I just want to see it, and we'll start from there. And
do you want to say how much you pay for it, Doug, or would you rather?
$20.
$20. And again, it's a 16mm film.
Plus shipping, yeah.
Okay.
So it's probably more like $19.88, because I usually bid a little lower than that.
I kind of figured that it either came from a school or library, and they're just cleaning out their stuff, because I've seen those kinds of sales at schools and libraries.
And it came from New York and New Jersey originally, yes. And I bought it from a guy in Michigan.
Okay. And yeah, that, like I said, that Lucerne company is a New York company. And, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I would love to track this down and either definitely find out, yes, it's in public domain, go nuts, or this is the guy who owns it. And the weird thing is, like I was saying earlier before the panel started, CNBC ran a comics documentary Easter week. They did it the Thursday before Easter, and they did it on Easter Sunday. And they had a quick clip of Stan and Archie going over the human fly designs and stuff. And it was just this shot of them talking, and someone's just talking about Stan Lee, Archie Goodwin, or whatever. So obviously they've got a copy of it. That's where it came from. And I was trying to look on the credits to see if they would, you know, have that information. But you know how they do that on TV? They have the tiny credits and stuff? Because they tell you about the show that's next, and I'm like, all right, we're screwed. I don't know. Sir?
Was the color better on that sequence that you saw on CNBC?
Not much. Not much, sir.
There were some people yesterday, they're doing a PBS documentary for
yes.
Have they seen this?
I'm not aware. I haven't met those
people. They have now.
Okay.
Oh, good. Oh, wonderful. Talk to you afterwards. Seriously, good luck with that show. It looks fantastic. I saw the trailer and everything for the presentation in New York. So, does that not come out till 2013?
The earliest will be fall 2013. Obviously, the focus is a bit different, but the fan, you know, sort of the burgeoning fandom here represented by this is amazing. You know, we've had this conversation, but I was as a kid, I was at those
conventions,
cons, and things like that. Was it the Commodore or Biltmore Hotel?
I was going to ask, do you think that was a New York con or do you think that was a Chicago con, that footage?
Well, they said Creation Con on the badge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, they did a couple Creation Cons here in Chicago, but that was, I'm fairly certain, was New York.
Okay.
It's a little hard to tell because in those days, they were all in, like, old hotel ballrooms.
Right, which all look the same.
You know, so, you know, here in Chicago, we were in the Congress Hotel, which is where Mayor Cermak used to live, and we were in the most beautiful room we've ever seen costume
things. It's featured in that piece too. I remember those times. You would walk the halls and look at the artists were just going. It was very loose and very for the faithful. And those costume segments, that's where the costume stuff happened. It's amazing to see the evolution today where people are so comfortable. I'm having a conversation at a hotel yesterday in a bar with a guy dressed as Adam West, Batman, and we're talking about cars. that just didn't happen back then, so it's wild to see where we come from.
I drive a Plymouth Duster up here.
I like
it. Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. It was an easy 70s car.
That's awesome.
Can I tell a quick Neil Adams?
Of course you can.
I sort of made fun of Neil because, well, screw it, it's Neil Adams. But I happen to think that was his best job ever in his career, and one of the seminal graphic novels, and really something that sort of stretched the imagination of superhero comics at that point in time. And I tried to talk Ilya Salkind, who was one of the producers of the Superman movies at the time, into doing that as the third Superman movie.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
They filmed the first two together. I don't even know if Neil knows this. And we had a long talk about it, and he read the book and, really sort of thought he understood it and thought it was great. He also thought he couldn't afford to shoot it. This would be like 1978, 79. The book came out in 78, right before Ali lost the crown. I always thought, boy, that would have been a great movie. And then they actually made Superman 3, and then I thought, wow, that Ali would have made a great movie.
I know at the time, they were considering Ali for Heaven Can Wait. And Ali was much tighter with the Muslim church at the time. And he said that he felt that Elijah Muhammad wouldn't allow him to do that because just something with the religion of like really like filming your image like that. So he turned out. But then a couple of years later, he starred in his own biopic. So he got over it, obviously. So I don't know. But that's interesting. And yes, I agree. It would have been a much better movie. I thought it was interesting, too, that Winters pointed out the philosophical difference between DC and Marvel in very layman's terms, kind of pointing out the Marvel style of art first, then story to plot and script over DC.
Do you know why that came about?
Please.
Well, first of all, it didn't start at Marvel. It certainly went back to Fiction House in the 1940s. And pretty much for the same reason. Stan didn't have enough time to write full scripts. It was faster for him to just dialogue other people's art. And you know, we attribute this to Jack Kirby because Kirby's such a forceful and brilliant artist. My God. But no, Jack wasn't even around Marvel at that given moment in time. He had really brilliant artists like Joe McNeely and even, you know, Steve Ditko and Don Heck and John Romita. But it predated Kirby, and it was there because they didn't have enough money to hire writers. They fired everybody except for Martin Goodman and Stan.
Yep.
And I think Jonathan Porton as production guy. And just printed off their inventory and reprints. And Stan just didn't have the budget to hire writers and couldn't write all the stuff that he had.
I know Romita has, and I know Kirby, obviously, there was a, you know, great argument between who created what. Romita pretty much says the same thing, but in a much calmer way, that he was kind of obviously plotting and coming up with these Spider-Man stories, doing this Marvel style and stuff, and he's just very matter-of-fact of it and would say he was taking car trips with the kids and, what do you guys think if Spider-Man and the Green Goblin did this and stuff like that? So, you know, kind of interesting. More questions? Sir?
Who was the voice of the DC Hotline?
We changed every... with every message. In point of fact, the only one that I rejected was Marty Pascoe's. Marty recut it into a whole different one, but he sort of ad-libbed a scene with Bob Kaniger, the War Comics writer, meeting out the window and shooting people at random. I thought that was probably a little over the top.
I don't know if you guys caught in the voiceover for the film, but that was Joe Orlando. And guys, if you don't know Joe Orlando, not only a great DC editor and responsible for the fantasy and mystery lines, as far as I've ever seen that.
He was also pretty much editorial director for quite some time. I learned more about comic book storytelling in 20 minutes with Joe than in hundreds of years of being in the industry.
Because prior to DC, he obviously made his bones at...
He started out at working as Walter Wood's assistant and as a science fiction illustrator, and then doing his own stuff at NBC, and did a lot of work over Marvel and many, many other publishers, but was with Mad Magazine forever. His ex-wife, his first wife, was one of their subscriptions manager for decades and decades. So.
Marty has told me amazing stories about how Joe explained, you know, comic pages, obviously, and I'm sure you saw in the film as well, how they are so much bigger, and explained how reduction would work on the page. And you saw, like, how great art would go from being so big and would look kind of wonky large, but then when they would reduce it, how it just really come to focus and how these guys could draw large knowing what the reduction would be and everything. And also, I know for Watchmen, I haven't confirmed this with Dave Gibbons, and on my next talk I hope to, but I believe Alan Moore had Orlando in mind. And in fact, I think there's a picture of Orlando in those pirate sequences of Watchmen and stuff. So,
Joe worked on that stuff.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, Joe worked on that stuff. That was... the twice up art was really beautiful. Some guys were never able to quite make the adjustment when it went down to the half up art. But if you look at Gil Kane originals that were twice up, you'd see how he would draw open for color. And he really gave colorists a lot of room to help to facilitate telling the story. A good colorist is part of the storytelling process. And Gil really understood that. And what was weird was that later on when he started doing all this beautiful black and white stuff, he still drew open for color. If you look at his Starhawk's work and you compare the Sundays to the dailies, it's the same stuff. He worked in the same style.
The coloring was done in what city? In a lot of cases?
Stanford, Connecticut.
Oh, I thought something was done back in Sparta, Illinois.
No. So the company was owned by the World Color Press, which was in Sparta.
Okay.
But it was not, the engraver was Chemical Color, and they were near where Adrian grew up.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected, and I'm glad. This is good. So that's the thing, honestly, this is what I hope when we do these things, that people can correct and provide more background on this stuff, and we can, you know, solve some of these mysteries. Sir?
So this is a little tangential, but I found it interesting what you said about how Stan Lee perhaps didn't put in so much effort or thought into the story itself. He put in a lot of dialogue. Now, if this was the case into the early to mid-60s, everyone, maybe in this room, likes to think about the fallout between Stan Lee and Ditko. And a lot of people talk about how that centered on who was the true identity behind the Green Goblin. if that's the case, I mean, would Stan have really been so adamant about it should be this guy and not that guy?
Stan gets a short end of the stick all too often on these discussions. Stan would be there as part of the plotting session. The artist was there too, obviously. That is common in all comics, and it should be. It's a collaborative medium. Stan's great gift was as an editor. Stan was one of the most underrated editors in comics history. And Steve and I have talked about this many times, as he has talked to many other people, and we're all sworn to silence. if you saw the TV documentary that Jonathan Ross did, he mentions this. Neil Gaiman and Jonathan Ross talked to Steve. Stan would have said, okay, and the big reveal is going to be blank. And Steve would go, no, we'll never see who the Green Goblin is. And Stan says, nope, we have to have a payoff. We've got to get people off of the hook. We'll do this whole Norman Osborn thing. That's the way it's going to be. And Steve said, no, that's wrong. The character was we should never know who the Green Goblin really is. And Steve, as much as happened, and was throughout every project I know of him being involved in the least, if he didn't believe in what he was doing, it's not a matter of getting his way. If he didn't believe in what he was doing, he'd walk. And he frequently did. You know, after that, it became a rights issue. But Steve was never in it for the money. He never said, I created Spider-Man, give me money. Because all Steve would have to do, and Steve was pretty hard up for money for a long, long time, very sick, is do a Spider-Man, signed print, sign 1,000 copies, and you'd be set for life. And Marvel would, particularly when Stan was there, would have gone for that 100% and done it for other people. And Stan, until fairly recently, was very sympathetic to Steve's plight. I think Stan, in his old days, was just had enough of it. I think he's just tired of it. And right or wrong, you can't blame him.
In the final minutes, I just want to give these guys an opportunity to tell you what they're currently doing, because I appreciate their help today. And Doug, I know you've got a cool little project that you're in the midst of.
Yeah, I'm doing covers for, actually not comics, but something close to it, Radio Archives, remasters and re-releases old-time radio shows. And I'm working on a series of their detective covers. I've done Johnny Dollar, Box 13, Adventures of Philip Marlowe. I'm working on Nightbeat, which is a Chicago show. And maybe eventually I can move on to some Shadow Whisperer covers for Radio Archives. I'm also working on my own graphic novel with my writer Aaron Shapps called New Dreaming Men. And that's something that we're developing and working for. Working black and white, all ages.
What's your table number here at the conference?
K-14.
There's really cool noir. If you like Chandler and stuff like that, honestly, go to Doug's table. The Philip Marlowe prints are amazing. Really, really cool stuff. And I've seen a lot of what he's been doing for Old Time Radio. They're kind of neat. And Mike, I wanted to ask you, obviously, what's going on.
Comicmix.com. I handle the columnists, including my own. Martha Thomas is the deal with the old John Ostrander and Michael Davis. And I'm blocking. Who else, Adrian?
Mindy
Newell.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah. Good stuff. We're putting together some new projects through Comic Mix and sort of associated with Comic Mix. We announced one of them at the first Comics panel yesterday. We're bringing doing a trade paperback with the Frank Bernard Warp issues, and Frank and I are working on the cover. We just started this week. We're looking at doing another Grimjack series. Tim, unfortunately, was in the hospital for a while, so he's a little late on the series, current series. But when he catches up and he finishes that off, John and Tim and I have already been kicking around a plot that I just love. And there's no more fun experience than with John Ostrander and Timothy Truman on Grimjack. It's just the coolest thing in my life, except for the progressive rock radio show that I do on GetThePointRadio.com. It's on demand. It's there. We run four times a week live, but you can get it on demand. I used to be on radio here in Chicago for 7 years, from 1969 until whatever 7 years later is. And Todd, I left to go to D.C. in 76. And it's just enormous fun because they let me do it. It's the internet. They let me do anything. And you know, okay, fine, I can curse. But the truth is, I can play long tracks, I can play deep tracks, which I do, I can play alternate takes. Stuff that you could barely do in radio when it was worth listening to, and with the arguable exception of XRT and a handful of other stations across the nation, you can't do. So I'm very proud of that. I'm really enjoying the hell out of that. It's called Weird Sounds Inside the Gold Mine. And that's a bad pun on Jim Morrison. And so I've got the point radio about now.
So there you go. We end with Mike Gold telling you where to find his internet radio website and station. And I just ended the panel with a little plug for what I was doing at C2E2 coming up to the Word Balloon table. You didn't need to hear that. That's okay. But it was a great panel. I hope you enjoyed all the information we got. And as I said, I hope to continue this at some other conventions. So keep listening to Word Balloon for more information. And we're going to continue to gather audio and video at these panels to build on what we have in that documentary. You know, so I think when all is said and done, we're going to have a nice little collection of memories of 1979, not only at DC and Marvel, but hopefully get guys like Jim Steranko to chime in as well. And we should have a nice little pastiche of different creators talking about that period of the Bronze Age here on Word Balloon. But now let's switch gears. It was Sunday. I was wiped out. I kind of let my energy go after that panel with what little gas I had left in the tank. I sat down with Pants from Comic Geek Speak, Jim from Raging Bullets, and was able to have this quick little impromptu fellow podcaster session. We always sit together on Podcast Row at places like C2E2. It's great when we're able to get together and have a panel. We didn't have one this year at C2E2, but it was a good opportunity to talk to the guys and check in and see what's going on. So it's Jim and Pants and me for a quick conversation here on Word Balloon. All right, given that there was no C2E2 podcasting panel, I felt it necessary to talk to a couple podcasters and just check in and, hey, stick the finger in the air, see which way the wind's blowing or whatever. But it's good. And Jim, I'm going to ask you again, God damn it, what's your last name? From Raging Bullets, it's Jim.
Segulin.
Segulin. Thank you, Jim Segulin. And, of course, you know him, you love him, Brian Crispin. Our own Pants. Pants and Rose, I like to call him, from Comic Geek Speak. It's good to see you, my man.
Good to see you as well, John.
Excellent. How was the show, boys?
It was absolutely wonderful. It was a fun time. A little bit different, a little bit weird, because I didn't formally have a table. I was actually out amongst the masses and got to dive into some boxes and whatnot.
Did you get anything good?
Oh, a couple stuff. Got a couple variant covers picked up. It's Nightwing number one. I have all the number ones of the New 52, but I have a second. So I have like two number ones of all the titles. Nightwing's the only one I only had one of. So I actually was able to find it. So now I have two of every of the new titles. Yes, I know it's a little bit weird, but I have my one set of ones that have never been read.
Very cool. Pants, did you get anything cool?
I didn't really do much spending. I did buy a couple of early dollar issues when I first got here Thursday for recent things I didn't buy when they came out. I didn't take too much back home with me because I got another con to go to in a few weeks. But this is the kind of con where you can just go crazy if you're not careful. That's why I'm happy I have a booth and by myself so I don't go out and spend the money, because the artists that are here, the creators, the retailers, there's just a lot of stuff. And boop, you go 5 feet. Oh, there goes $100 right there.
I'm with you, man. Absolutely. I only I went through my own collection, and I always have like reader copies of like old Silver Age stuff. And I was really happy knowing that Joe Kubert and Neil Adams were here. I got them to, both to sign some cool covers. And especially the Cupid covers. I'm really happy about those, man.
I love that yellow background cover you got signed. That is beautiful.
Sergeant Rock, hand-to-hand combat with the Nazi one-on-one with this amazing, yellow kind of... I'll show it to you, Jim. It's pretty cool. Actually, I should probably, put them up on wordballoon.com. They're really amazing. And then it was great. My buddy Jeff went up to Gail Simone's signing. And Gail's been a friend and enemy. A frenemy, if you will. For years, and she cracks me up every time she comes on the show. But she wrote a nice little rant on a Batgirl number one cover of the New 52, and it was cracking me up. So I'm content with those. Although I do see more kind of reader copies of Bronze Age and Silver Age stuff on a few of these dealer tables that I don't get before it's over. But podcasting, guys, how's everything going? You know, as I like to say, you guys are part of
Pants represents one of the Mercury 7 shows, one of the original 2005 shows. Raging Bull started 2006, right?
We just celebrated 6 years, so yes.
There you go. So that's cool. I call you guys the Gemini 9. It's all right. If you didn't start in 2005, it's 2005 and everybody else, but you're 2006, I tease guys like Chris from around comics and stuff, so I always put things in astronaut terms, the Gemini 9. But honestly, no, how's the show going?
Well, it's been growing great. You know, it's episode 300. We had 300, 301, 302. Talked about the Batman Nightfall, all three trades, and just had a ball with that.
Very good.
Doing it our own little style, so it was nice, long, mini episodes. Lengthy discussions where you delve into the material and you have fun with it. You go on a topic, you know, that you never thought was going to happen, but this type of writing brings out a passion. It brings out a discussion, and you just, you know, let it flow.
Excellent. Pantsaru, I know you're kind of captain of the ship right now as Deemer takes a little hiatus, although I heard him on a recent episode.
Yes. He'll be back every now and then. He was on our most recent episode with Wild Pig Show. We're trying to focus more on things we just want to have fun with. I mean, the old shows were great. I love these spotlights. We used to went on Spider-Man the Silver Age. Those are great because they're very in-depth. But I hate them because they make me to go back and read things. And I can't waste all that time reading things, but I want to read all the Silver Age Spider-Man stuff now. So we're doing that. We're doing our previews. We're just trying to have fun and, you know, doing what we love doing, talking about comics.
Excellent, man. Hey, no, honestly, I congratulate both shows in terms of still being around, you know, 6+ years and everything. I think that's great. Warp Balloon is about to celebrate its 7th anniversary in just a few weeks.
7-year itch.
Indeed. No, you know, honestly, and I the pursuit continues. It's the same mission that it was from the beginning, have interesting conversations with creators. And I appreciate the differences in our shows, but also the similarities. I don't know. What else? I mean, you know, this digital thing that we talked about last year in San Diego and Chicago, I think, is still at its start.
Yeah.
But I really am impressed with, as much, and Jim, I want you to comment on this, although I know you're a DC-centric show, but I really do think it's interesting how the creator-owned initiative is really going crazy as it coincided with the 20th anniversary of Image.
Yeah.
And every month, almost every week, I hear about an established art team or writers and artists that are pursuing creating their own stuff. Rod Rice, who was just here, the colorist of Aquaman and Nightwing, was telling us that they got a little creator-owned thing going on with Ivan Rice and Joe Prado. So that's terrific. But I think it's really cool. And, yeah, what are your guys' thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just there's so much. I can't keep up with it. I can't keep up with these announcements and everything. Like, I'm in Seattle. There's a big announcement about Mike Norton and Tim Seeley. I didn't find out about it until a few weeks later from them, like here at the con. As far as the digital stuff goes, I'm more of a traditional tactile guy, but I got a chance to look at the Infinite version of Marvel's, I guess, the Nova from the Avengers X-Men. That was amazing. Because Mark Waid, Stuart Immonen, exclusive content. That's awesome. If that's the future of digital comics, then I might have to get an iPad. But honestly, God, I was so blown away by it. Deemer brought in his iPad and looked at it. That's awesome.
Was it all like 3D, some 3D effects?
Well, it was. It sort of had you couldn't advance the panel until you swiped it, and it wasn't a full page. It was like panel by panel, like things coming into focus. When you see a full panel on a comic book, you see everything. Your eye goes to the bottom. Here, you're focused on the one panel, and the way it was done, I think, was brilliant.
Mark's doing that too with his own digital creator-owned stuff.
I would think he would.
That Luther PDF that he has at markwaid.com.
Okay.
We've been talking about that as well. I saw some stuff, and I can't reveal publishers, but I think they're really doing kind of that interactive thing where you're getting 3D images, you're getting quick little, not flash, I guess it is kind of flash animation, but in some cases I saw video quality moments because the art was very realistic of a character suddenly talking. And like, wow, almost coming off the page and having a quick comment and stuff. So if they are going digital, it's interesting the different bells and whistles they're putting out. But what do you think of what you've seen so far digitally?
Well, next generation, you know, well, current generation is actually pretty neat. I am a more of a, I'm like Pants, I am more of a paper guy. You know, it just, pardon me, it's, I'm not really tech savvy and I'm not really tech friendly. I'm the guy who they wrote, you know, the Idiot's Guide for. That's me. You know, and they're like, oh, it's user friendly and, you know, even stupid people can use it. That's for me then, because I really have no technical savvy, but I'm seeing this stuff come out. I'm seeing the next generation, you know, 2-3 generations down the line. It's, there's going to be some really cool, you know, just effects and just motion and actual just animation in a way. You mentioned like the Flash animation. It, we're already seeing some of that type of styling going on, and every generation just thinks new, thinks a little different. You know, what they're coming out now is pleasing the next generation, pleasing the crowds, you know, the younger, you know, the younger readers. So it's, I'm looking forward to, I fight change.
Yeah, me too.
I do,
oh, yeah.
But I am looking forward to what will come down the line, what will be the next generation. And I, it's going to be an interesting, you know, 20, 30 years down the line. Sure. What we have will be completely different than what we have right now.
Definitely. What do you guys think? I know movies are coming up, but we're still pretty far. We're still a few weeks away. But things that are going on right now in television, DC Nation, Marvel's animation and stuff like that. Have you watched? What do you think?
Oh, definitely been watching DC animation online. Well, not online. The DC animation, just the general.
What do you think of the interstitial stuff, like the Wallace and Gromit style animation, and really the other shorts and stuff?
Oh, I'm liking them. You know, it's fun. And a lot of times people say comics, you know, when they throw out fun, they kind of, it's not a it's a bad word to use. And I never understood that, because comics are supposed to be enjoyable. They're supposed to make you laugh. They're supposed to have fun. Yeah, you have serious discussions. You have these really, it's true literature. It's true artwork in there. But in the confines of that, you can still enjoy your stuff. You can still laugh. You can see, like, those Animal Man shorts that they've run out there that are completely off base on what Animal Man in the comic book in his own series is that's currently going on. But I'm still, I'm howling when I'm seeing something. He goes, hello, the pie becomes a chicken. And I'm like, what? He doesn't do that? But I'm still laughing.
Did you see the Green Care Bear? It was this weekend. I caught it this morning, actually, as I was getting ready to come to the con. And instead of him, Hal Jordan becoming Green Lantern, he became the Green Care Bear. And it was really cute. It was a very funny thing. But, yeah.
Well, I think it's cool that this generation has Saturday morning superhero cartoons. That's what I grew up on. Super Friends, you know, Batman and Robin, Spider-Man. And to have it in a nice little block with the Young Justice and the Green Lantern series, I think it's great. I really like the Supergirl, Wonder Woman, Batgirl short that they had recently. I'm just looking forward to more comics on TV as well. I mean, it's that's how I grew up on. I want kids right now to experience what I had.
It's a great introduction. You think about all of us.
We talked about that last year at the podcast, Ben. Absolutely.
All of us. This was our intro. Comic books. Was the cheesy DC, the cheesy Batman television series that I watched in reruns. That was one of my introductions to Batman. The Super Friends cartoons, that was also reruns for me. That was my introduction. These were my introductions to the world of comic books. And right now, we have these really nice, solid stories that are being crafted. The Green Lantern animated series. You know what? That's a really good Green Lantern story. I would like to see that in paper format. You know, maybe fleshed out a little bit.
I wish it was a live action series. Yeah. Although, honestly, the sophistication of storytelling, both in Young Justice and Green Lantern, I love the Avengers. I don't want to short shrift Marvel too, because I really do love the Avengers cartoon. And Spider-Man, Ultimate Spider-Man, has really been fun.
That's a start. Now that's on with Disney XD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't get that on my cable, but I hear good things about that, and I want to see that.
You know, they at the very least they have the first episode online.
And I
keep watching them late night because I'm a bum on the weekends and I totally sleep. So I usually catch the stuff on demand. And I was talking to Jeff Loeb because at night Disney XD only shows the half-hour episodes without the interstitial stuff. But he was telling me that all of those shorts that they're doing, because they're doing what they call Marvel mashups, where they're taking the old animation Spider-Man and his amazing friends, and they're redubbing them with funny lines and stuff. And he said they're really funny. They are on Marvel's website, so if you haven't seen them yet, check those out. All right, I don't want to keep commerce away, and I know fans are waiting to talk to Pants, but I wanted to take a quick moment and say hi, have a quick discussion with you guys. It's good to see you. Hopefully we can get the podcast panel going again next year here at C2E2. But if not, we'll always like pull you guys aside and make sure we say hello and see how things are going. So, Raging Bullets, make sure you check it out. Comic Geek Speak, they are the it gets the workflow seal of approval. They are not our enemies. They are our friends. Remember that.
Thanks, John.
Guys, thanks a lot. Pants, Jim, good to see you.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
There you go, Pants and Jim, also me, a quick little podcasting conversation to wrap things up for this edition of Word Balloon. And don't worry, we'll go back to our usual extra stout versions of our episodes on our next episode. But I hope you enjoyed what I gave you for C2E2. Don't forget, if you want to hear the Aw Yeah Podcast live panel, that's going to be on the next episode of the Aw Yeah Podcast. You can go to wordballoon.com, and as soon as you see the player change to the new title card, you'll know that it's there waiting for you. But also just link to their homepage as well, which is awyah.libsyn.com. And you can download direct there. Or, of course, you can always grab the feed and subscribe to the Aw Yeah Podcast. It's always fun with Art and Franco. I'm sure you enjoyed last week's episode with Kelly Sue. And we heard Art and Franco separately. They're back together again with their Pal Yoko chips. And it was a good time, and the audience seemed to enjoy it as well. I hope you will. That'll do it, though, for this episode of Word Balloon. Today, of course, it was sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Great deals going on. Scott Snyder, 50% off the hardcover version of Severed, just $12.49 at InStockTrades.com. Are you enjoying iVampire, part of the new 52? You can reach back 30 years. Check out those first stories. The trade paperback, 40% off, $17.99. Anthony Johnson presents Daredevil Season 1. Just 38% off, $15.49 at InStockTrades.com. The prequel trade for Avengers vs. X-Men, $12.39. 100 Bullets Volume 2, the big hardcover, 40% off, $29.99 at InStockTrades.com. Eric Schanauer, The Forgotten Forest of Oz, the Treasury Edition, is just 40% off, $5.99. Don't forget, if it's your first time ordering from InStock Trades, you can get up to 42% off. Free shipping if your orders are $50 or more. And make sure you check out all the deals. They are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Suntress, as always, saying thank you for listening to Word Balloon. Thanks for your support. If you came to C2E2, I hope we had a chance to say hello, but had such a nice response. It's always good to see all the listeners and, of course, our creator friends and our fellow podcasting friends. And can't wait for the next convention. Man, it's been a full month, but it's nice to cool our jets off. I think Summit City in Fort Wayne in May is the next convention that Word Balloon will be at. And that's going to be a fun little show that we enjoy supporting. It's put on by our friends at InStock Trades and Discount Comic Book Service. Zach Crucey does such a good job curating that show. And it sounds like it's going to be good. Our pal Gabe Hardman is going to be over there. Jeff Darrow is going to be over there. Lots of the Chicago and Michigan community flocked to Indiana for the Summit City Con. So you're going to see a lot of cool people. Tom Scioli is going to be there. Really, really neat lineup of artists. It's a nice artist alley for a mid-sized show. And do yourself a favor, check that out. Summit City Comic Con. Google it, and you'll get more information. But that'll do it. Questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can also reach me on Twitter under John Word Balloon or on Facebook under my name, John Suntress. I'm happy to talk to you. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2012.